guys, it's basketball. It's not a f***ing soft sport.
I love it, Gabe. I love it.
Back to the NBL podcast. My guest on today is Matt McQuaid. Quick turnarounds. We had a game on Friday night. We have today, Saturday the 14th of March, and then the game on Sunday evening. That's if everything goes as scheduled and coronavirus doesn't again rear its ugly head. But nonetheless, I have Matt on and we talk about everything from Game 2 and this series so far and how we see things playing out in Game 3. I hope you enjoy this one. And as always, like, review, and subscribe.
Matt, my first question is, I think the big takeaway from this game, Andrew Bogut, standout game. Was he just aggressive or did you see something strategic from the Kings that changed his performance?
Oh, I think it was his aggression, but I think fundamentally it's just a much better matchup for him than what Sean Long was. You know, Sean Long's sort of playing as a stretch five who can, you know, run out to the three-point line and did knock down some shots in that series and made Bogut look incredibly old, you know, particularly in that game two debacle for the Sydney Kings. But I think, you know, far from being the Bogut killer that I thought he was going to be, and I think the Wildcats thought that as well, it's been Miles Plumlee has been the one getting killed because I just think Bogut's much more comfortable against him and can go to some of his, some of his moves inside, the spins, the power drop steps. His movement is a lot better than we've seen, certainly in the previous series. And, you know, and in this series, it's been basically, he's been the difference in many ways. And you look back at game one, it was probably a game the Kings should have won when you're up 11 points late in the third quarter. You let the Wildcats hit those two threes and they kind of got some energy and confidence from that. But this game, it was pretty much Bogut, to me, really energized them. The way he was playing, you know, particularly in that first quarter. I mean, 12 points and 6 rebounds in the first quarter really set the tone for the Kings. And defensively, the Wildcats just had no answers to him, no matter who they tried.
I think definitely when you say set the tone in that first quarter, especially in such a unique circumstance, like there was, if ever it was needed for a guy of his age and caliber and experience to say, all right, crazy circumstances, but here's how we're going to play the whole game. I thought he was exceptional. He did get a couple of post-ups in this game, only maybe two or three, which hasn't been the Kings at all. Were you surprised to see that?
A little. As you say, it hasn't been. He's been mainly used as a high-post facilitator, but when we're calling the games, myself and Ben Knight, we're always calling for him to get low touches because I just think, his movement in the low block is exceptional still. And you saw what he did to Plumlee, and Plumlee's playing so far off him. Bogut's just getting whatever he wants to in the paint. And I don't know what the Wildcats do to change that up. I think they need to start thinking about doubling him. Damian Martin did it once, stripped the ball from him, if you remember. When they doubled him in the post.
And I think stripped the ball.
Stripped the ball. But I think the Wildcats are going to have to change up their defensive coverages because clearly he's dominating whoever he goes against in single coverage. So, you know, they're going to have to give Plumlee some help. And I never, ever thought I'd say that. But the problem with giving him help, he's so intelligent and he's one of the greatest big man passers in the history of the game, not just in this country, but worldwide. He's right up there as a passing big man to anyone you want to name, whether it be Arvydas Sabonis, whether it be Bill Walton. And I've said this many, many times. So that's going to mean that a lot of these Kings, the perimeter guys are going to get a lot of open looks the remainder of the series if Trevor Gleeson decides that he just can't single cover him anymore.
I mean, let's jump to Miles Plumlee. Is he struggling or do you think this is his ceiling? This is his game? He hasn't scored at the other end either.
He's just been completely taken out of it. And I think it's really hurting them. There are a couple of things that hurt them in that game. And Plumlee was one of them. And they brought him over, as I said before, specifically to be that guy who could match up on Andrew Bogut because Trevor Gleeson did not believe, and he said this in a press conference, that Dario Hunt was going to make them a championship contender. And by championship contender, he knew in all likelihood you have to go through Sydney. So that's why they made the move and pulled the plug on Hunt, who wasn't getting the job done, and you bring in an NBA guy in Plumlee, bigger guy, more athletic, and can do a few more things for you, more of a rim protector as well, that he's been thoroughly dominated in this series. I mean, it's been Bogut, you know, two 10-8 rounds, if you like. And that's been a huge key. And I don't think after the three games of the Melbourne series that Trevor Gleeson was expecting this from Bogut, though. I think you're looking at a guy, his movement, it's still compromised. I still believe he's got the back injury, and I think they managed it extremely well. But I tell you what, when he ripped down that thunderous dunk in the third quarter, which nearly tore the rim off, that's the biggest dunk he's had since he dunked on AJ Ogilvy in that game against Illawarra last year, where he destroyed poor old Ogilvy, put him in the grave. But that one was similar, and he did it over Nick Kay. It was just an awesome dunk. And again, those kind of things energize the Kings. And I mean, it must give you tremendous confidence to know that you've got this guy who's had back-to-back double-doubles now in the two games of the series. And you could easily make the argument. I know that obviously Bryce Cotton's Bryce Cotton, but quite frankly, I think Bogut's been the MVP of the series so far.
Yeah. I was about to say he was in the zone, or as I like to call it, the quarter zone, when we're talking about Bogut.
Very good. Yes.
Thank you. Well, Plumlee, he had that big game against New Zealand. What did he do in that game that could perhaps be replicated in game 3 or 4 or 5 going forward?
Well, I think the Kings defensively are doing a really good job in denying those alley-oop, those low catches in the low block, that kind of baseline flex cut movement, which results in a lot of those alley-oops. You remember that they were just throwing it up to Plumlee, and he was just jamming everything. I mean, essentially, I don't know how many dunks he got off alley-oops alone, but it was a bunch in that game, and had that 23-17 and thought, oh my goodness, well, this is the missing link. But I think the Kings' defensive coverage so far in this series has been excellent, because you just haven't seen it. That the drops coverage there, that, you know, Will made some adjustments to it last night in terms of taking away the Wildcats' mid-range game. But I think they're doing a better job, similar to what Melbourne did to Sydney, of kind of clogging up the baseline lanes and making it tough for Plumlee to kind of, you know, run that sort of pick-and-roll action where he's dropping down to the basket and there's always a guy, there's a body or two that goes with him. So they really haven't had that kind of action. And the thing about Plumlee is he's not a guy who's really a threat otherwise to score in the low post. It's just not his game. He's a rebounder and rim protector primarily. Any offense you get out of him is a bonus. I mean, he can score, but it's really not what he was known for in the NBA. And it'll be interesting to see if the Wildcats make an adjustment to that as well. And that's what a 5-game series is all about. You know, the Kings adjusted beautifully last night to what the Wildcats were doing, particularly with Cotton in that fourth quarter. And I'm sure Trevor Gleeson, a great coach that he is, will make his own adjustments for game 3 in Sydney.
You spoke about adjustments, and I was looking at Will Weaver's substitution tally and substitution pattern during the week. Have you ever heard him describe his rotational rationale, like why he makes what is, I mean, just looking at the tally, I don't know if you saw it, but he makes almost double what Gleeson does. Yeah, not that that's good or bad. I just want to know what the rationale behind it, if you've heard.
It's kind of interesting, because I've wanted to ask him several times the issue I've got. Well, the problem I've got is that because I'm writing the game reports for the Kings, it's sort of not incumbent upon me to ask that kind of a question. I want somebody else to ask it, like an Olga Nulich or, you know, somebody else who kind of knows the game. Because, game one was a classic example of why sometimes you just scratch your head at his substitution patterns. He's got – it's very much structured. You know, Jae Sean Tate hits a three, then he has a steal and a dunk. He's got 5 points in about 60 seconds, and then he gets sat straight away. And you're kind of like
– 7 minute and 17 second mark.
Yeah, what the hell is going on here? But that's how he runs with it. He's very structured. I think to the point – sometimes he doesn't perhaps like to go with a guy that's in rhythm. You know, I mean, he did the same thing to Kevin Lish. He did the same thing to Sean Bruce. He hit a couple of shots and sit down. Casper Ware, who was, we'll get on to him in a minute, obviously struggling mightily, hit a shot in game one and was sat immediately. And you question it sometimes, but obviously he's got a plan. He's got a very structured plan that he's sticking to. He's been very steadfast. He calls it chopping wood on how they do things. I do think last night, however, that he did make quite a few significant changes that really helped the team that were necessary. One was defending Cotton. The other was defending that mid-range game and making it a lot tougher. And by not dropping that drops defense that he uses with Kickett and Bogut, by not dropping them as quite as far and having better communication around them, it really stymied the Wildcats significantly. So, yeah, it's really interesting with Weaver getting back to his substitution patterns. I don't see it changing. I mean, you look at the minutes. No one last night played more than 29 minutes. That was Casper Ware, and everybody's playing. Even Jay Sean Tate, who was completely dominant yet again, and still didn't take enough shots for my liking. He only played 24 minutes. 24 minutes of a 40-minute game for an all-NBL first-teamer. It's extraordinary.
I mean, I looked at the substitutions again. So he had 46 in game one, 44 today, yes. 8, 11, 12, 13, you know, 7, 12, 11, 16 last game. So it hasn't, you know, minor differences with a few foul things, but it hasn't changed. And even Tate came out at the 7-minute mark of the game one, came out at the 6:50 mark of game two. So, it's interesting how it goes. The one name I want to bring up to you, Matt, Tirico White, is he struggling due to a Sydney Kings defense, or is it something personal? Are you seeing a sort of fear in his game or anything? This is normally his time, or it certainly was last season. It hasn't happened. What do you think?
I think he's injured, and I think he's been out of it for most of the year. I really do. I mean, he hasn't had the season most people expected after he won the grand final MVP last year. He's a terrific player, but I don't think he's been healthy all year. I really don't. And I think he's carrying a knee injury. I think he's way, way down on his effectiveness. It's not just what the Kings are doing. I just think, you know, he's one of these guys that's sort of hard to get a read on from an emotional standpoint. You know, he's very kind of stoic. You don't really get anything out of him. But last night, I just thought his head wasn't in it. And I think part of it is frustration because he knows he's not 100%. Now, the Wildcats are not going to say anything about it, but I think it's obvious that he's carrying an injury. And I don't think they can win this series without him. And I think, you know, I was a bit concerned after game one because I think that was a game the Kings probably should have won. Mm. And we know the Wildcats' championship pedigree. And of course, that unbelievable home court advantage, which unfortunately was taken away from them with the coronavirus. But still, I expected the Wildcats to win last night. And I thought Tirico White would have a good game, but he's clearly hampered. And I think it's getting to him emotionally now as well. But like I said, it's very hard to tell with him.
Mm. Casper, sticking with the same theme, Casper Ware. I don't think he's carrying an injury, Casper Ware.
He's not. How
would you describe it? Not just this series, but the one before. I mean, he's had one game in double figure scoring or decent shooting in the last month. What do you think?
He's missed 15 consecutive triples dating back to game three of the semifinal series. His last triple of the playoffs was at the 7-17 mark of the fourth quarter against Melbourne United in game three. It was a go ahead three. Look, I think Shay Ely, for a start in the Melbourne series, really got into his head, and I think he's really struggled from there. But, I just think that he's really pressing way too hard. What I liked about last night, however, was that, and it's something Liam Santamaria, who's doing a phenomenal job with his analysis on nbl.com.au and on television, mentioned that, you know, when Casper played for Melbourne United a couple of years ago in their championship win, his mid-range game in the playoffs was deadly. You know, he was just playing very free. And you wonder, you know, Liam asked the question, is Weaver having these conversations with him saying, look, good shots for this team are threes and at the rim? And is he kind of trying to work through that? And I thought last night he kind of took a step forward. Missed a couple of threes again. I mean, he missed four threes on the night, but he only took four shots in comparison to 10 shots in game one. And he started to find his floaters in the paint, which I thought was really key for the Kings. That if that can continue to happen, where it's not so difficult because they are still giving up that mid-range in the paint kind of floater. And he can knock that down, and maybe that's a way to get him comfortable. But yeah, look, I mean, he's going through the worst slump of his career, obviously shooting the ball. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think he's really struggled in terms of he's turned the ball over a lot, not so much in game two, but definitely in game one. Some of them were of the diabolical variety, unfortunately. But I thought I saw some good signs in game two. You know, I mean, clearly he's struggling offensively, which makes what the Kings did even more impressive. The fact that this is your guy, this is your leading scorer, and he's having the worst patch of his great career that he's had. And yet they still pretty much dominated the Wildcats, and they've been the better team over the two games, really, when you look at it. So it's been only Bryce Cotton was the difference probably in game one. So, it's kind of one of those situations from a glass half full perspective, is that he really has enormous upside, doesn't he? You know, you just wonder if he's one of these guys that could hit. It could just take one three or two threes for him to get his confidence back from the perimeter. And if that happens, well, the way the rest of the team is playing at the moment, the way Bogut is, the way Kevin Lish is, it's just hard to see. And the depth that they have, and I think that's probably going to be the key in this series, the depth, comparative depth of each team. I think it's hurting the Wildcats at the moment.
Cotton and Kay scoreless in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that and they scored 10 points at home. You know, regardless of whether the Red Army was there or not, you know, 10 points is 10 points.
Yeah.
And it just shows you that really they, you know, and the Kings are defending them brilliantly. And especially, you know, as Liam again brought up, the fact that Bogut or Kickett is guarding Damian Martin and essentially letting him have at it. You know, they're showing them no respect, and neither they should. I mean, Lord knows, Damian Martin's my favourite player, and I maintain, I know Boddy Nodge talks about other players, but I'm sorry, but Damian Martin's the greatest defensive player in NBL history, and right. There's none better, and there's never been any better. I know Boddy and I have arguments about that, and Boddy's point is that Damian isn't an offensive player, and that has to have some input into it, and that's why Darnell Mee was so great, etc., Simon Dwight, those guys. But I just think the way he normally or has done, not so much in this series though, but what he has done in the past in being a guy that can change the outcome of a game at that end of the floor is unparalleled. But in this series, he's clearly lost a step. Father Time is undefeated, as they say.
Yeah.
And offensively, he's a liability. And the Kings are playing off that. I think Will Weaver just made a really intelligent choice. They're giving him 15, 20 feet and just saying, go for it. They're not even worried about those floaters yet. He did drop a couple of those patented left-hand floaters of his. But really, they're kind of low-percentage shots, and that's what Weaver wants. I think they defended the rest of the Wildcats exactly the way they should, and I think the addition of double-teaming Cotton in the fourth quarter and getting the ball out of his hands, normally, you know, the guard, you saw Newley come up and blitz a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
I think that just makes life really difficult because it makes other guys beat you, and that's what you want. And Nick Kay, I think Jay Sean Tate's done a tremendous job on him throughout the series so far, which is I thought that was a big key as well. As far back as the preseason, you know, you and I were talking about the signing of Jay Sean, what that meant, and if he was going to play the four spot when you were going up against guys like a Nicholas Kay. And how that might look. Well, Jay Sean's probably won that matchup, I think. There's a lot of things the Wildcats are going to have to change if they're going to win this series. And one of those things is they've got to get production out of anybody else not named Nick Kay, Bryce Cotton, and Clint Steindl, because really they're not going to get that much out of Plumlee. They're not getting much out of Tarico. Mitch Norton, really, and Tarico. See, that's the key. I mean, Tarico White opens everything up for them because you can't cheat off him if he's going. He's not going in the series yet, and unless that changes, it's going to be very Cotton or no. It's going to be very difficult for the Wildcats to win this series.
I think when I saw those doubles on Cotton, I was like, I think the lineup that the Wildcats, if they're in a situation where they kind of have to throw SHIT at the wall. Bryce Cotton, Tarico White, Steindl, Kay, and Wagstaff. Just no defense, no offensive, I don't want to use liability, but no offensive shortcoming on the floor. Everyone can potentially shoot it, you know, even Tarico White, who's struggling. That, to me, is a lineup that I'm interested to see if it takes the floor going forward.
I think they'll have to, and it's something they certainly used it in the Cairns series because they couldn't play Plumlee. That was the big thing because Plumlee just wasn't a matchup for Cameron Oliver at all. When they went to that small ball lineup, as we thought they would, it was extremely effective with Nick Kay at the five and Jesse Wagstaff as a floor spreader at the four. So offensively, you're quite right that if you put an alignment out there with Steindl, with Tarico White sort of playing a small, you know, a bigger two guard, and then those two forwards that can both shoot the ball, it's probably their most effective, you know, from an offensive standpoint.
I mean, I just felt the Wildcats, as much as we look at, say, you know, how well Bogut played and things like that, I thought their defense was really meek. I just didn't think they had any – this crowd thing really knocked them around. I that sounds quite ephemeral and whatever, but I really felt like they just didn't have they weren't stopping guys in the paint. They weren't banging. Maybe they've kind of done it all. They did it a little bit in game one as well. I don't know. Interesting.
I don't think defensively they've been anywhere near what they've been capable of in previous years. I actually think the Kings are very comfortable against them offensively. I think the Kings, you know, in game one particularly, a lot went wrong of their own making. You know, it wasn't necessarily what the Wildcats were doing. They did pick up the heat a couple of times. I mean, you did see the odd occasion in both games where they put that sort of killer press on with Damian Martin leading the way, and they did turn the ball over a couple of times. But then it's something you expect more of. You know, they run that 1-2-2 trap press into, and then they fall into that zone typically, but and it causes havoc. But in this case, they just haven't done it consistently throughout the year. And I think their defense was awful. I agree with you. I mean, we can get onto the Red Army and the impact in a moment. But, you know, I think one of the standout stats from last night, and it was the foul count, 25-15. Mm. And it's the biggest differential against the Wildcats at RSC Arena in history, in a game. In history, and because they always, I mean, this year they led the league in foul differential. And what I mean by that is that on average, other teams were called for about 3 fouls per game more than the Wildcats were. That's just the way it is. And obviously, and it's more accentuated at RSC Arena. So, yeah, but defensively, I don't think they're where they should be. I think it's been a problem all year. I think part of it is the fact that Damo is not what he was. I think he's a half step slow, which is natural. But I think as a group, I don't think they're a good defensive group, or at least not what we expect out of the Wildcats typically.
Let's go to this one. Should this game have had fans in attendance?
No, I don't believe that. And as I said, I think Larry Kestelman and Jeremy Lehlinger have done exactly the right thing. I think... You know, they certainly took their time. They worked through the pros and cons, but ultimately it's about health and safety. It's about the health of your fans. You know, they're your biggest constituents. It's about the health of your players. It's about the health of your officials. It's just an exercise in risk mitigation, and I think they did it exceptionally well. I think the fact that they are even holding the games is important. I think the games still need to go ahead no matter what. We've got to get a champion, particularly at the end of, you know, where we are in the season. And Trevor Gleeson in the press conference was clearly aggrieved at the fact that the Red Army wasn't there. And look, let's be brutally honest. You can't use it as an excuse for the loss, but I've often said that the Red Army is the best six man in the league, and they're also worth. And look, this is kind of throwing the proverbial against the wall, but the reality is, in my opinion, I think they're worth 10 points a game to the Wildcats. And I think it's a number of reasons. The energy that those players feed off, the officials calling those 50-50 calls more towards Perth than they would against the other team, not just Sydney. That wasn't there last night. I challenge anyone to show me where the Kings, where the fouls that were called the Wildcats weren't there. They were there. I mean, they were absolutely there. It's just that they tend to let more go if the crowd's there. Look, it's just human nature. It's psychological. I mean, I've spoken to plenty of NBL coaches about the psychological impact of that crowd on referees, and they all say the same thing. There is a definite impact at RSC Arena. There's no question about that. So the fact that the Kings were called for 10 less fouls than the Wildcats doesn't surprise me at all. The fouls were there. Plus, the Wildcats, when were they attacking the rim on a consistent basis? That's what you have to look at. You have to look at the shot chart. You have to look at things of that nature to really give a considered response and a factual response to why it can't just be, well, the league wants Sydney to win. I mean, that's just an absolute furphy and a nonsense. And but as I said, this is what happens at Perth Arena. I mean, it's documented that typically, RSC Arena, I should say, typically the Wildcats will get called for fewer fouls than their opposition. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with the pressure that the Red Army puts on the officiating. It is a definite thing.
I think also, to play the other corner of that as well, is when the Red Army is there, that team is the aggressor. The script is
correct.
Perth are the king. They're the ones attacking the hoop. They're the ones hitting the bodies hard. And when you're the pace setter, that you know, you set the pace, and the officiating follows. Yeah,
agreed, 100%.
So we both agreed. Game three, what shouldn't and won't have fans in it. What about, so game three is scheduled, right? For obviously, tomorrow night.
That's right. Yeah, tomorrow afternoon, 5 o'clock.
Game four and five. Is there a talk at all of, okay, let's stop after game three, close doors, wait till after the 30-day the ban on gatherings over 500 and perhaps resume the series with crowds after that? Is there any talk of that? Do you think that's a good idea? What do you think?
No, I think they have to play it out, because the thing about the 30 days, I mean, obviously the NBA has shut its doors for 30 days, mm-hmm. but there's no guarantee that 30 days might not extend out to 60 days or 120 days. And then you start getting into the kind of deep into free agency. I think they've just got to finish it out. I think they'll just play games three and four as normal. And then obviously if game five is required, I just don't think it's practical to just, you know, turn it into, I've heard talk about, let's make it a three-game series. Well, that's not practical now. That really isn't. And it's unfair to both teams, in all honesty, because they've been preparing for a game five, so or a five-game series rather. So, yeah, look, I believe that they'll play it out. I think they'll just play it out without crowds. It will be incredibly disappointing for you know, a championship is a championship is a championship, right?
Sure.
So I mean, and I don't subscribe to this asterisk nonsense. I think they're all professionals. You play it. These guys have played in front of nobody themselves when they were kids, or you know, younger guys and moving up. And just because it's the fans aren't there, you just can't turn around and say, there'll be forever an asterisk against that championship. I don't buy that at all.
From an aesthetic point, like from an entertainment value, did you watch it on telly, or you're on telly? What did you feel of that game watching it? Like I gotta say, I naturally didn't enjoy it as much. I think that's pretty fair.
Well, it's interesting because I was calling the game on radio here in Sydney mm-hmm. with Julian Dawes. So we called it in this instance. So we always are at the venue, but this time we didn't go for obvious reasons. So we were calling it a la the commentary hub in Melbourne. So we, again, we were using a screen. And we've done that occasionally this season. So for me, it's interesting. I personally think that it wasn't as difficult. I thought we called it pretty much the same way, but then that's because we've done it before and it didn't worry me about the crowds not being there. I think what'll be harder for us is that we'll be in the building on Sunday.
Myself,
Julian Dore, Ben Knight will be there on SWAT 999, and you know, we're actually calling it, and that's going to be because we feed off the crowd, and you know, that was one of the big criticisms. I mean, you remember we've chatted about this before, about the business about the hub and how, you know, being a commentator, you do feed off the crowd just as the players do. You really do.
Sure.
And it does, you know, and it's much more difficult to do that. You know, and I've called many, many games from a screen, be there CBA games or NBL or Australian games over the years. And it is a difficult thing to do if you're not exposed to the crowd. So I think for us, the three of us on Sunday, that's going to be the challenge, is how do we you know, make sure that it's we bring across the excitement of the game, the fact that it's a grand final, without the obvious atmosphere, which clearly won't be there. You know, unfortunately, it was going to be probably 14 to 15,000 people there based off the early ticket sales. Now there won't be. So that's a challenge for us.
Trevor Gleeson brought this up in his press conference. Should these games, maybe not three, but should they be played in Perth? His point was, you know, we're not allowed to play in front of fans, but we're allowed to go to airports, which are another hotspot for coronavirus. Mm. That hypocrisy, did you find that interesting? I mean, there is a strong thought that if you're not going to play in front of crowds, just do the rest in Perth.
Yeah, it would be, again, I think a little unfair. I agree with Trevor to a point, but I think, because my idea was, I actually thought they were going to play game three in Perth, and then if games four and five were needed, they'd go back to Sydney and do them there. That's what I thought. But again, it's one of those things where you've already, you've set the expectation that it's home away, home away, home, and it's very, very difficult at such a late stage to switch that. I think the other thing, and I've brought this up to a couple of people in the NBL, that, and I don't know if that's the case. I mean, it's it's still fairly early in Perth, so I don't know if they've travelled this way. But I thought that it should have been the NBL should have arranged for a charter flight for both teams.
Really?
And basically have it just them. Yeah, because, you know, they talk about, look, the Wildcats were on a plane coming back from Sydney with someone who was positive to coronavirus. So why not take, you know, you're talking, as I said before, you're talking about this being a whole exercise in risk mitigation. Well, risk mitigation is putting the teams and their support staff and coaching staff together on a flight, on their own flight, with absolutely no passengers, just them, and fly them back to Sydney and fly, and then fly, obviously, Perth back to Perth on a charter as well. And just that's how you would risk mitigate it. Now, I have no knowledge of whether that's been done or not. I haven't looked at Twitter to see if that has happened. So, you know, I thought Trevor had a really good point, because it's a point that I made, that if you are going to fly them back, especially on such a short turnaround to Sydney, why take the risk of flying them commercial? Even though I have a friend who's a flight attendant for Qantas, and she said to me that, you know, one of the things that, that they've got, it's a filtration system in the air conditioning unit that works exceptionally well. You know, it's designed to sort of filter out a lot of these bugs as such. So it's about as clean as they can make it. That said, it's still a risk. It's still a risk. If, you know, anybody can jump on, as we've seen, that doesn't have any symptoms and infect somebody, because even though they've got no symptoms, they actually have the thing, you know, a la Rudy Gobert.
Yeah,
you know, that's one of the classic examples of that. So, yeah, look, as I said, that it would have been, for me, the prudent choice from the NBL to do that. I don't think it would have cost particularly that much money as such. So it will be interesting to see if they did, in fact, do that and put them on a charter flight.
You know, it's interesting. If the Wildcats really wanted the Red Army in attendance and wanted to do a bit of gamesmanship, Trevor Gleeson himself could say, like, actually, I'm feeling a bit fluey. I've got to put myself in isolation. And could delay the sit. They could do all that. Don't do that. That would not be.
Absolutely.
That is going to be... I don't know what happens there.
They'll cancel it. I mean, this is the thing, and they've already said that I think if a player is actually going to test positive for it, they'll cancel the series. And I don't think they
just call the season or just reschedule.
I just don't see how you can. How can you? You know, this is the thing. We don't know how long this thing's going to last, and this is the uncertainty. And you're getting into the free agency starts, what is it, 2 or 3 weeks after the final game of the season. So, you know, there's going to be different players. You know, the teams are going to look completely different to what they are. And I just don't think it's practical, you know, and that's why I think, fingers crossed, we can finish, and I'm sure this is how the NBL sees it as well, that we can just finish this thing out and then have that space for our fans to recover and for free agency to proceed as normal. And, you know, the teams can build in the off season.
Reload again. Yeah, wow. I mean, yeah, crazy things. Going back to the game a little bit, Cotton looked frustrated. He was getting doubled off those picks. And when you talk about, like, did you see that? When we talked about sort of Tariqa White not being able to score so much, Damian Martin struggling, it really looked palpable on his face. Did you see Cotton struggling with yesterday?
Yeah, he did. And as you mentioned, I think it's a clear frustration, because it's based on the fact that he's just carrying a gigantic load. And I think it's starting to wear on him a bit. As great as he is and as fit as he is, and his ball movement is the best in the league. His movement off the ball, rather, is the best in the league by far. The problem is the Kings, if they continue to double him off those pick and roll actions, whether it's the middle, whether it's the wings, if they ice a lot of those pick and rolls, if they blitz him, which Brad Neely was doing a lot of, he has to give the ball off. And the problem is then you're expecting Tariqa White, who has been terrible, to knock down shots, and he's not doing it. And Steindl's a bit hit and miss, although he's been good, I think, in the playoffs.
Did okay.
He's always good against the Kings for some unknown reason. It's quite funny over the years. But, you know, and there's too much on too few for the Wildcats. And this was one of the keys in the series, I think, was the depth. You know, I mean, I think the Wildcats go 8 deep at most. You know, once it gets past 8, you know, you're really struggling to see what sort of an impact these guys are going to make. No disrespect, but I mean, that's just a fact. Whereas, you know, everyone knows the Kings' depth is pretty much the best in the league. I don't think there's any doubt about that. When you bring in 2 6 Man of the Year candidates in Sean Bruce and Daniel Kickett, then you've got Divi Lazada, an NBA second round draft pick now coming off the bench. Then you've got Craig Moller, who can't even get on the court. You know, Craig Moller was huge for this club earlier in the season. Now he can't even get on the court. He's played a minute in the series. So this is the thing. He played zero. He didn't play at all in game one and only played a minute in game two. So you kind of look at that and you think, well, the Kings are just absolutely loaded. And it comes back to the substitution patterns. I think Weaver, and I know Boddy Nodge, you know, my friend Boddy on the Brad and Boddy podcast brought that up, that, you know, Weaver thinks is probably overcoaching a bit. And I think there's a little bit of truth to that, because I think he kind of sees all this talent. I've got to get this guy a minute. I've got to get this guy. There's kind of that thing in the back of his head where he knows how much talent he's got and he wants to get these guys in and out. I mean, I go back to what I said about Jay Sean Tate. I think playing Jay Sean Tate 24 minutes is ridiculous. He should be playing 30 minutes a game. I mean, he's just that dominant and that unstoppable. But that's what he does. When you've got Xavier Cooks now coming in, again, another guy to take more minutes in that rotation. Look, it's tough for Will. I really think it is difficult for him, because he knows how much talent he's got. Sometimes there is such a thing as too much talent. Certainly not the case last night. You know, last night, I thought he coached a very, very good game. Now, I thought it was actually one of the best games he's coached all year, because the truth of the matter was he was outcoached by Dean Vickerman in the Melbourne series, got away with it.
Yeah.
Definitely outcoached by Trevor in game one. But game two, he really did a fantastic job making in-game adjustments, and, you know, spoke about that before with Cotton and kind of not dropping down as much in the paint to disrupt that mid-range game of the Wildcats.
One last question I had. Obviously, Kevin Lynch had a really good game. Was there ever any thought when there was that sort of Deshaun Taylor, his injury replacement nomination, was there ever a thought of, oh, we're not so sure Kevin can go, we're going to go Taylor, or maybe, oh, Moller, is that injury still bad? Okay. Was that ever up in the air?
No, I think they were expecting Lish to play. I think the thing about Lish is he's incredibly diligent, as we know, with his rehabilitation. Yeah. I don't think anybody works harder outside of Damian Martin, to be honest with you. I mean, his work ethic is incredible. So I don't think it was ever a consideration. I know there were the jokes about, well, you know, Lucas Walker's going to mysteriously develop an illness. But they were, you know, to their credit, they didn't go down that path. And it's a damn shame, because the thing about Deshaun was, later in the season, once he got his feet under him, he just came good. And, you know, you can see the talent there and the kind of guy that would fit well in a number of programs, you know, that defensive point guard who can actually stretch the floor, is a better three-point shooter than what people believed initially. You know, start of the season, I think he was shooting 15% for multiple games, and then ended up, I think he finished the year at just under 40 because he had a few big games late. But as Will Weaver pointed out, when he was in college, he was a 40% three-point shooter. So the guy can flat out play, and there's no question about it. And I think he would be an outstanding third import on a number of clubs. And if they, you know, he's certainly showcased himself extremely well through this season. So don't be surprised if someone picks him up in the off season, if not the Kings, which I don't think they will. I think the Kings will probably go bigger at that third spot. But I think, you know, you can easily see him fitting into, say, Illawarra, for example, you know, as one prime example.
To be honest, the team I thought who he would most fit on right now and would be gagging to get him for this series would be the Perth Wildcats. Yeah. Give them something different at that one, someone who can shoot it but is also maintains that defensive intensity. He's going to be the subtle, sneaky pick of the offseason, because there is a bit of a risk with him where it's like, well, he only played, you know, he had that struggles early, played well late. You know, where do people place his talent on the we're both high on him. Matt, that's all I've got for you. If you've got any final thoughts, remarks, questions, queries?
Well, I think just obviously the great disappointment of a series that for me was looking like one of the all-time greats. It still might be, but obviously without the fans, it kind of loses that luster a little bit. A bit of the air's come out of it. I still think it was a really – I mean, look, for me, and obviously I'm coming from a different viewpoint because I'm calling the game, I really enjoyed game two. I thought it was very well played, particularly in the first quarter. Both teams really shot the ball extremely well. I certainly agree with you that Perth are not as physical as they have been, and certainly at home. But yeah, look, I under the circumstances, I still hope it goes five. I think it deserves
it.
I
will.
Think it's been the two. It's funny. I actually thought if Perth won last night, they'd sweep. Now I'm in a mindset that the way the Kings took it to them and the way those adjustments were made, and the Plumlee thing is really a problem, you know, against Bogut. And if Bogut, one of the big question marks about game three is how does Bogut turn around on such a short turnaround? You know, how does he feel physically?
Good point.
After a short turnaround? And that, I think that's going to show us if Bogut can come through and be as effective as he has been in the opening two games, it's really difficult to see, especially if Casper Ware steps up. Now, we don't know if that's going to happen, but if Ware steps up even a little bit, with all the talent that's playing so well for the Kings at the moment, it's hard to see the Wildcats winning another game in the series, which after game one, I can't believe I'm saying that, because I was almost convinced that the Wildcats would sweep the Kings. But, you know, even though, because I thought the Kings had played very well and still lost because the Wildcats just figured it out like they always seem to do. But, you know, things have changed, obviously, with the Red Army no longer there, and that's going to be an issue in game four. Again, still some question marks. Game three now that becomes the pivotal game of the series.
And I think going on, I mean, the Red Army is a huge factor, but the bigger factor is Will Weaver's shown the willingness and ability to change and change for the right, and the blitzing Cotton. I mean, it was so successful for Cairns, and you would think it would go the rest of the way. Matt, beautiful. Thanks very much. And I'll speak to you again sometime.
My pleasure.